morning. I'm happy to entertain questions about the exam if you want, but I wasn't planning to say anything more. There was the usual distribution of performances. That's normal. Nobody failed. I know some of you will look at your grades, oh my God, I've never done that bad. That's normal for a class at this level. So there were A's. There were things that were not A's, but there's nothing that, like, you're going to fail. Okay, so don't worry about that. The median, I think, was 19. The high was 24 out of 25. The low was like 11. And there are plenty of people all across that spectrum. Right? So you're not alone, wherever you are. Now, that is one reason why I've structured the class the way I have, so as long as you do the homework, you won't fail. Right? There's you'd have to work to fail even if you don't do well on the exam. And there's another exam and then the final, so there is part of the opportunities for it. Okay, so then we'll go on and talk today about the distance scale. I hope to finish that up. This is the third class we're devoting to that because it is topical again, and it, as I said before, it has dominated the history of the subject. Until it was solved, and then it wasn't solved again, and that's happened off and on for forever, and probably always will. So we'll talk a little more about Tully-Fisher and some other methods, and talk about absolute methods, geometric methods that hop over most of the rungs in the distance scale ladder, so that you are not concerned with the calibration of Cepheids and so forth, and what the modern Hubble constant tension is. Historically, there was a big debate between whether or not it was 50 or 100. That has narrowed down to whether it is 67 or 73. That sounds better, but the formal error bars are much smaller, so it's still a real tension. And if you're old enough, like me, to remember the 50 versus 100 debate, the difference between 67 and 73 seems small, but it's not. It's statistically significant, and we'll talk about why that is. The 67 comes from the fifths of the CMB, which we'll get to later in the course. So we're talking today about the more traditional methods, most of which could be something around 73. I've also noticed the note that sociologically, when it was between 50 and 100, there were a lot of us, especially the more theoretical physics community, which I came out of, that it had to be 50, right? There are these two numbers on offer, and you just couldn't have a universe that was had H naught of 100 because it wasn't old enough to hold the stars that we knew were at least 12 billion years old, and at the time more like 18. And so we were absolutely convinced on that side that it had to be 50. And then I switched fields and started doing astronomy and started meeting people who actually measured the number, and they're like, oh, maybe it's 80, you know, people like Tully. And I was just like, well, you know, that can't be true. Only it was, right? So don't be too sure is the lesson there, just because you think it's sure. And I mention that because I'm seeing the exact same sociology out of the exact same communities that people who are really into the theory side of it believe the CMB number absolutely. We've been wrong before, and we can be wrong again. But I will explain why we think the numbers are what they are, for data reasons, and they are different on both sides, and they just are. So who knows? Could come out either way. All right, we finished up last time talking about Tully-Fisher, and I thought I should say a little more about that. I work on it, so I take a lot for granted. It's all news to you, so ask questions if I leave things unclear. This is the stellar mass rotation speed, relation, and this is the baryonic mass where we've added in the gas mass, so all these gas-dominated galaxies move back up on that relation there. This stellar mass, really, I've just used a constant mass to light ratio that's the same for everything in this particular plot, so it's just the luminosity. That's the traditional Tolle-Fisher relation. It's the luminosity measurement, and the rotation speed is usually measured by the line width that we discussed last time. It's a proxy for this, but not a perfect proxy. What I showed you last time was just the good data, things where the distances are known to be more accurate than 20%. That's the colored points there. There are other data. If you throw that on there too, things that are not that accurate, then the scatter is bigger. That's what happens when you throw up mud at the wall, right? As you loosen up the selection criteria, then you expect the scatter to get bigger just because the error bars are bigger. And you can see that by eye, right? The gray points have bigger error bars than the blue points. That was the selection. The relation is, when I say it's tight, it looks tight if you plot the good data. It doesn't look tight if you plot the bad data, but that's because it's the bad data, or at least lower quality data. You can go through the math and basically predict how the scatter should get worse. And that almost works. That is to say, for the higher quality data that are shown in blue there, the amount of scatter that you see is entirely explained by the size of the error bars. Right? You just imagine putting points on the line and then saying, assigning some random error to it, then it scatters by that much. So those data are consistent with being drawn from perfectly thin line to the level that we can discern. That's not quite true. It's almost true for the gray points, but there are two components there. The random errors are bigger, but there are also systematic errors that start to creep in. Right? And that's not quantified by the size of the error bar. So a few of these things, V flat is not measured because he didn't actually get far enough out along the rotation curve. Or the distance is just wrong because we're accepting now any distance measurement, and maybe that's a Hubble velocity. Maybe it's in direction of the Virgo cluster where the possible distance for a given precession velocity is double or even triple valued, and you picked the wrong one. Right, you have to pick one. There was an important case of this lately, some ACG galaxy. The phone number I don't remember, that was way off. And Federico Lelli pointed out to me that, well, you know, if you just picked a different, well, he didn't do it this way. He had a different distance estimator, and it was right on Tolle-Fisher, and he went back and looked. And sure enough, it was one of those triple-valued points, and the right distance that put you right on Tolle-Fisher just happened to be a different choice of that triple-valued velocity. The scatter here is intrinsically small, but what you get depends on how you measure it and how you control for uncertainties, both random and systematic. The other thing to be aware of is that most applications of this that you will find in the literature are restricted to bright galaxies. They don't have the dynamic range that's illustrated here. They're just up in this corner. In a sense, that's kind of good because these galaxies are star-dominated, and so the luminosity is a pretty good proxy for the baryonic mass, and the relation works fine. If you just use the luminosity version of this down to lower luminosities, then you get this mess here, and it's not such a great experiment. But this is just the selection effect we talked about a couple weeks ago. Bright galaxies are the things that are easy to see. You look far away, that's what you get, so this works pretty well. Were they gonna ask what the red point is? I'll say it if you're not gonna ask. That's the Milky Way. You are there. So, we know the distance to the Milky Way very well. It's hard to estimate its total mass. So this is the underlying relation, and you can still don't really understand the physics that drives it, but it seems pretty clear that it's the total baryonic mass that matters. So you can use other proxies. But you have to understand the limitations of those things, that basically you're sampling this in an imperfect way. As long as you account for that, then you should be okay. There is a limitation here that you can never reduce the scatter due to stellar population mass to light ratios. You can never perfectly convert the luminosity into a stellar mass. And so there's always going to be at least that much scatter. But there's more scatter in the traditional version because there's also contributions from the line width, which is, like I say, an imperfect proxy for that. And the fact that, you know, there is some gas mass, so you're not getting a perfect proxy for the baryonic mass just from luminosity. Okay. So, colleague of mine, Jim Schomburg, to the University of Oregon, did this a few years ago. So this is the baryonic mass, the baryonic Tully-Fisher relation, calibrated by 50 galaxies. By the standards of this field, that's a lot of galaxies. And the different colors here are different absolute measures. So to calibrate it, you have to know the distance to each galaxy by some independent method. And the dominant ones here are either the tip of the red giant branch, the red points, or Cepheids, the blue points. And I highlight that here because they give you the same answer. You don't really see a difference between those two. But if you go out and listen to people talk about the tension in the Hubble constant, one of the concerns currently is that the local measurements that tend to give you 73 or thereabouts, that there is a tension in the calibration that you get between tip of the red giant branch and Cepheids. And in some samples you do see that tip of the red giant branch gives you something more like 69, Cepheids give you something more like 73, and that's exactly the kind of calibration difficulties we've historically had with the distance scale ladder. However, we do not see that in this sample, right? And so it's a bit more complicated than just Cepheids versus tip of the red giant branch. And it looks to me like really it's a tension between one group's calibration of the tip of the red giant branch and another group's, or not even calibration so much as how they implement it. So that seems to be where the tension is rather than with Cepheids. And for this particular set of calibrations, there is no tension. And we get a high, relatively high Hubble constant, right around 75. Another thing, another reason I bothered to write this out, it's not the best measurement that's out there by any means, but it is a good one. But what you will see written a lot is sort of two plus or minuses, one for the statistical errors and another for the systematics. It was not always standard practice to do it that way, and it's still not always done that way. Other things you can do are just ignore the systematics and say we don't know that, or give it a ballpark, which is what Tully does here. That's the more traditional thing. Or you can combine them in some way to give a total error budget, which Reese has been doing recently, which I really hate. But, you know, just that you should be aware that those are all things that people do. So when you read an error bar, you need to be careful to read what kind of error bar it is. So the statistical error bar, that's just a straight random error, the usual experimental error that should account for all the sources. One issue we come up with a lot, run into a lot in astronomy, is that random errors are not always Gaussian. They're not, they have a weird distribution sometimes. So we write them as if they were, so that's usually a one sigma error bar, but again, you should read what they actually say it is. Sometimes people will quote two sigma or some arbitrary percentile range. So this, we did that, that's one sigma, that's what we think our one sigma uncertainty is. And then the systematic, there are lots of things that contribute to the systematics. The big known unknowns that are systematic for us are one, the intrinsic scatter, right? So how well you can measure a distance depends on how good that relation is. So when you just measure your distance independent quantity, how good is it at predicting the distance dependent quantity? So if this has a big scatter, then, you know, that makes it harder to apply. So that's small, because the scatter here is relatively narrow, though it's always limited by that scatter in the stellar population mass to light ratio. The other thing that dominated here was the flow model. The Hubble expansion is not perfectly smooth, right? There's bumps and wiggles due to perturbations from things like Virgo and so forth. Tolley has mapped this out reasonably carefully, and so we use that, but other flow models are possible, and that was the other big contributor to that systematic. So of course, Tolley has been doing this himself since the 70s. His latest number is 74.6 plus or minus 0.8. That they are in agreement is not too surprising because we're using the same calibration samples. Right. So if you change that, then both of our numbers would change. But they are in agreement. Notice that he has a much smaller statistical error. That's because he's using line widths, which are relatively easy to get observationally, and has something of order 10,000 galaxies where we have of order 100. Right. So you win statistically by having lots and lots, but you by using that proxy, you're not getting as accurate a predictor, so there's more intrinsic scatter there, so the systematic is larger. Can't get away from that. And he estimates it about plus or minus 3 kilometers second per megaparsec, but he does get that twiddle because, and that's really always been the case in astronomy in general and the distance scale in particular, that there's always unknowns, right? We can estimate the amplitude of the known unknowns, but if the calibration's just completely off, well, that's an unknown unknown. We don't know that, or we would account for it. I don't think that's the case, but it's happened before. Probably will happen again. But those methods, Tolley Fisher basically is giving us 75 right now. And there are cross checks that one can do. So this is the calibration using the known distances from either Cepheids or Tithyrid giant branch. You can take that line and ask, okay, does it work in the local group? You know, the distances to local group galaxies pretty well. And yes, there's no obvious offset between the local group galaxies, right? That line is this line. There are independent things there. And it even extrapolates pretty well to lower velocities that are calibrated. On the other hand, you can go up, and this is now just assuming a Hubble flow, what Tolley Fisher relation do you get? Of course, to measure the Hubble constant, you ask, what distance do I have to put each galaxy on that relation? But if you just say, okay, let's accept the Hubble flow that Tolley measured, and then you get the same relation, and there's just no indication of some weird systematic going on there. All right, so that's a warped example, as it were. Now you can go out and do the same thing with the fundamental plane for elliptical galaxies, or any of the other indicators that we've talked about, and people have done a lot of that. The literature on the subject is enormous. Okay. All right, so I want to go on and talk about things that skip over that distance ladder. So just like the trigonometric parallax is a degree direct geometric method to get the distance to relatively nearby stars, there are some absolute methods that rely on geometry in one way or another that give you, in principle, distances straight to cosmologically distant sources. So shouldn't have to worry about calibration at all. So some famous examples are the light echo, gravitational lens time delays. Those both depend on the speed of light to be your yardstick. The Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect, which involves Compton scattering and hot plasmas through the clusters. And then water masers, which are just wild to think about in space. You get these amazing situations once in a while. So I just want to describe to you how those work and what answers we're getting at the moment. And you see illustrations of each of these things here. Light echoes from some central source, some kind of dust ring around the central source, which is blocked out here. But so you can see that there's light bouncing off of something. And that gives you an extra distance. So if there's a feature that where that's varying, you can see the variation with a time delay based on the light travel time from here to there before it gets to your eye. That's the effect. Gravitational lenses, a bunch of examples. So we'll go through each of those. Okay, first one, light echo. In order to do this, you have to be in some sense lucky to have a source that provides you with an echo. And so one famous example is supernova 1987A. This is the nearest supernova explosion to have gone off in living memory. Not your living memory, but mine anyway. And it was nearby. In the Large Magellanic Cloud, which is near enough that you could see it. It's a naked eye event, and it was discovered because somebody in Chile at an observatory walked out and was like, but where'd that star come from? It was literally that kind of discovery. Here's the layout. We're in the Milky Way. The Large Magellanic Cloud is a satellite about 50 kiloparsecs away. Picture of the whole thing. It's a barred Magellanic. It's basically the prototype for a particular morphological type of dwarf irregular. And it has this active star forming region up here, which has some colorful name like R139. Something, I don't remember, something silly like that. We're just terrible at naming things. Dorados 30 is an alternate name. Anyway, you zoom in on that and you see this big nebula. That's all H-alpha emission from ionized gas that's excited by very young, hot O stars. This is the most intense concentration of O stars in the local group. Lots of massive galaxy stars right there. Biggest star-forming event going on at the moment in our local group. And so perhaps it's not too surprising that there was a type 2 supernova that went off, though this messed up a lot of our expectations at the time for what a type 2 supernova should be. Some folks here did a lot of the foundational work to go back to plates and figure out what the star that exploded was, what the progenitor was. This is useful because you had this flash of light. And it turned out that there was a ring of dust around it that we saw in reflection. So late stages of stellar evolution are a mess. There's all sorts of complicated things that go on. There are all sorts of different mass stars that do different things. But it's very common for them to shed their outer layers to some extent or another. So you'll get outer rings and shells of material out there. And apparently, before it completely blew up, the star had basically shed a more or less circular ring of dust, not perfectly, of course, but It was then lit up in reflection, because first the supernova went off, the light propagated out to that ring, and some of the light reflected off of that ring into our eyes. And so you could actually see the propagation of the reflection, first hitting the nearby side, and then propagating around the ring, coming up the other side. So here's the geometry we're observing over to the left. If the supernova goes off, there is this pre-existing ring of dust that is, you know, tipped to our line of sight at some angle. We see the flash first, and we see reflections from this with a delay that depends on how much extra distance the light has to travel to first hit the ring and then travel to us. And that's just geometry, right? There's just that sign of this inclination angle that makes a difference. So the first, we see light from the flash directly first, that's A. Past B, we see it light up off of this ring first, and you can measure that 90 days later that happened. Then you could see the propagation around to the other side, which happened 400 days after the first flash.
This being the nearest supernova event of many, many decades, people were observing the heck out of it. So I was not able to find a movie of that, but you could actually see the propagation from one side to the other. Right, so those are the observables. We know when the time delay is between one end of the reflection and the other. And if the ring has a perfectly circular geometry, negative, right, then the extra distance you have to travel is just that difference. Everything has to go through A, that's the one. But then you get a little extra distance from that term. First you have to travel the distance of the ring, but less or more depending on whether you're illuminated the near or far edge of the ring. And that's just the light travel time, right? How long does it take the light to get there? And so that's just C delta T, and so you get those 2 points, and you have 2 observables, the 2 unknowns, the radius of the ring, and its inclination to our line of sight. And so you can solve those 2 equations with those 2 observables for those 2 unknowns, and you get a pretty good number. It is about half a parsec, not quite, which is a plausible distance for material to have been expelled for the star and to reach before the whole thing goes off. And some intermediate angle, right, just whatever it happened to be. Okay, so separately we can measure that angle, right? This is an angular diameter distance. LMC is close enough, you don't have to worry about the cosmological term, we're still in the Euclidean limit. But still, you can measure that diameter. And now we know a physical radius, so we can basically solve for what the distance is to give that angular diameter for that physical radius. And the answer is 52 plus or minus 3 ABC. Plus or minus 3 is not great by modern standards, but you know, this was a while back now. And it is consistent with modern estimates. So the cool thing here is that we've not talked about Cepheids or main sequence fitting, or any of those earlier rungs in the distance ladder at all. We've skipped over all that. The only thing we have to know here is the geometry of the system and the speed of light. How it comes to distance. So that's nifty. That's an independent check on all the other estimators that tell us it's about 50 kpc away. Okay. Now, it's only once in a while that nature gifts you such an event. So a more common application of the speed of light as your absolute ruler is the time delay in gravitational lensing. People recognized this pretty early on, but it has a long and sordid history. I think it's gotten more reliable now. But the physics is simple.
straightforward. So there is some source of background quasar, and you need it to be variable. Right? If it's just steady, you're not going to be able to do this because you're not going to be able to recognize differences in the path length. But if you have some background source that is variable, then as the light passes through some intervening mass that's massive enough to lens it, then light that was trying to go this way gets deflected to your line of sight. Light that was going that way gets deflected. And if things are not quite perfectly aligned, then these path lengths are different. Right, so there's a slightly different angle, alpha 1, alpha 2, from this to that. Right? And we're very good at measuring angles, so even small angles, you can, in principle, do this pretty well. And so what you see projected on the sky, you just see where the light came from, so it projects real in the source plane. The quasar is directly behind the lens, very nearly. But in the image plane, it's been split into these four images. And each one of those has a slightly different angle away from the center of the lens. And so you can look at the difference in those path lengths. That'll give you a time delay, and that's what this formula tells you, that time delay depends on the potential of the source that's doing the lensing. That's how much bending you get. For this purpose, you don't care too much because it's the same for all those things. Right? So this is a big uncertainty, but it's also something that mostly cancels out in this exercise. I say mostly because the potential can have some shape. So it might have a vector that affects things differently. But mostly it's the same. So mostly this term cancels out. And then you have just the ratio of these distances, right? Distance to the lens, the distance from the lens to the source, and then those differ just by those individual angles. So you can get those time delays out of that. Just because this photon has to travel a little further to get to us than that one, just because that angle's a little bigger. So that's great. It's another geometry thing. We can measure the time delays. We know the speed of light, and so that gives us a handle on these lengths. The trick in practice is recognizing the time delay, getting that measurement. So quasars are variable sources, so their fluctuations in brightness go up and down, and you see that go up and down. They're very noisy. They're almost white noise, so it's actually hard to say, oh, that bump up is the same that I see 40 days later is the same bump up, because they all kind of look the same. So it took a while to sort this out, and he got some nonsensical answers early on. But nowadays we're really good at doing Fourier series time fluctuation comparisons, and so this seems to have gotten pretty good. And there was an entire program devoted to doing this called Holy Cow. I forget what this acronym stands for, obviously, H-naught, lensing, and I don't know how they work a cow into it. We have some really tortured acronyms these days. And they got good measurements for, what, half a dozen things? Yeah. And this is the basically measured uncertainty. So each one gives you an independent measurement of the Hubble constant. That is, you're getting a geometric distance from the time delay and knowing the speed of light for each of these things. And they plot out the uncertainty distribution there. So each colored quasi-Gaussian thing there is one object's measurement. And then you can do statistics and say, okay, that's the most probable value, and that's what they reported, is 73 plus or minus a little under 2. Are you happy with that? Or should we trust the statistics here?
It's like, well, these all look pretty consistent. Oh, what is this guy doing? These guys are not the same. So, yes, when you turn the crank and do the statistics, this is the answer you get.
should we believe it? They're often outliers. Maybe he's probably far enough away the Hubble flow doesn't, shouldn't be non, shouldn't, shouldn't be different. But anyway, you know, what you get here does depend on the width of these errors, right? These two outliers, they don't contribute much, but that one does. So if we just say, oh, let's not believe it, then this number will come down to 71 or so, something like that, which is within the errors, which is what statistics does for you. But, you know, we would care about that. But in principle, nice geometric method. And that's all what works. Okay. Now, like I say, there are lots and lots of ways that we've come up with doing this, and I'm sparing you things like Botta-Wesselink, and there are even more obscure things, but you will hear all these things discussed, so I want you to at least have some grasp of what they are and how they work. So another interesting method is the Sinyat-Zeldovich effect, just SE for short, because God knows if I can say that right. But this is basically due to constant upscattering of microwave background photons. So here's our observer. There's some cluster along our line of sight. And there is that surface of blast scattering from the cosmic microwave background, the relic radiation from the hot Big Bang, which is sort of the ultimate surface of Olber, that, you know, that's where you can't see any further because the universe is opaque beyond that. So the entire sky is a screen of low temperature radiation, famous 3K background. And that microwave background is propagating to us from every direction on the sky. So anywhere that there happens to be a cluster along the line of sight, will have this effect in principle. In practice, it needs to be pretty hot to be noticeable. And what we care about is basically the temperature of some density of electrons here, because the electrons are the things that are scattering the photons as they propagate through. So, you know, as an optical observer, I think of a cluster of galaxies as a bunch of galaxies all near to each other on the sky. Don't care about the galaxies here. We care about the plasma associated with that cluster through which the light has to propagate. And here are images where the green is basically that background screen of the microwave background. So that's what the sky looks like. And then there's a cluster in front of it that's either boosted the intensity of that or taken a bite out of it, leaving a hole there, and I'll explain how that works. But so there is that background screen, and it has to propagate through this cluster to get to us. And so the intensity is affected by the hot plasma there. And it is a very hot plasma, but you need that for this to work. Okay. Oh my God, equations. Like so many things, this looks really intimidating, but it's mostly just simple physics and geometry. So you're basically going to change the intensity. Oops, I left out the U there. Make the backslash. Fix that real fast while I'm thinking of it. That's an old image. It doesn't fix. Oh, well, anyway. So basically, the change in intensity at any given frequency follows this from this formula, which depends on just x here is just, you recognize this from quantum mechanics, right? This is the energy of one photon, and this is the energy in the radiation field. So you're going to boost the energy of those photons, which of course have some blackbody distribution. And how much boosting you get depends on this Compton Y parameter, which in turn depends on the Thomson scattering cross-section. That's just how good electrons, free electrons are at scattering photons. How many there are, the number density of electrons. So for this purpose, the cluster is just a big bag of hot electrons whizzing around. Protons too, but since they're more massive, they don't do nearly as much. Right, so basically the electron density that matters. And then how hot that is, how fast those things are moving. So that is T sub G is the temperature of the gas. So that KT up there is basically the kinetic energy of the gas. And that's relative to the rest mass energy of the electron. That's why the protons don't do as much, because that's much bigger, and so that takes the whole scale down. And so there is a difference in temperature you have to worry about here. The gas temperature, that's a kinetic thing, what we usually think of as a temperature. And then separately, there's the temperature of the radiation field that's propagating through that. That's the 3K, or whatever it was at the redshift of the cluster that we're in. Because the universe is expanding, and this is going down all the time. So when these clusters have a significant redshift, then the temperature was higher back then. And that's non-negligible for even modest redshifts. Okay. So basically, the Compton Y parameter is just the integral over the stuff in the cluster. How much scattering it can it do? The more electrons there are, the more it does, and the hotter it is, the more it does. That's how much energy is available in the plasma to boost the energy of the individual photons. You get this funny equation, which I don't remember the derivation of, but right, the physics is easy. You got a big bag of electrons, that's going to impart some energy to the CMB photons by the Compton scattering as they propagate through the plasma. And so the net effect of that is to take the input spectrum, so you have that nice thermal spectrum, pure black body spectrum from the microwave background, and note the wavelengths here. Microwave background has an intensity that peaks around 2 millimeters. Really, it's the millimeter background. We just discovered it in the microwave, so we call it the microwave background. Most of the energy is at millimeter wavelength. But anyway, we know what that spectrum is very well, and after it passes through this cluster, it gets deformed, right? You're just adding that amount of intensity based on that formula. And so the net effect is basically to shift it to a higher effective temperature. So that changes the intensity that you measure as a function of frequency. And you're basically taking photons away from the low energy side and adding them to the high energy side, right? So you get a boost in intensity at high frequencies, but you get a deficit at low frequencies. So if you go out and measure a bunch of frequencies, then you expect this characteristic shape and change of intensity relative to that initial microwave background, which is a way scaled down version here, just so it'll fit on that. So it's a subtle effect. But if you look at all those frequencies, then you can see easily to see the difference between where it's boosted and where it's deprecated just because of this shift. And that's what it looks like. Right? So that, again, that green background is the 3K radiation field, and you know, in most places there's no cluster in the way, as we will talk about later in the course. The entire universe does reionize, so there's a little bit of an optical depth to the surface of blast scattering just from free electrons throughout the intergalactic medium, but that's a small number. And not what we're talking about. So this is a large, relatively large deficit just due to that ball of electrons that is a cluster of galaxies along the line of sight. So you can see at low frequencies, you basically are taking a bite out of that. The intensity is less, right? This shift happens, so the intensity is less here. Then I have those stupid builds. And then on the other side, it's going to get boosted. So at higher frequencies, you get higher intensity, just as you got those lower intensities. So that's just from the shift of the Compton boost. And there is some crossover point where you basically don't see the effect at all. It happens at about 2.17 gigahertz.
Right, so that's that effect. And what we saw there, right, I've mapped these images onto their observation frequency, the crossover point, you don't see anything. At higher frequencies, you've added some intensity, so it's boosted. On the lower frequency side,
you've taken some away. And so that pattern is really easy to recognize so long as you observe enough frequencies. So even though it's a subtle effect, you can go out and hone through the data. And the Planck satellite measured the microwave background well enough that you can sometimes see this and actually extract what the Y parameter is. And, there's even something called the kinematic SC effect, which is that little dotted line there, which tells you about the peculiar velocity of the cluster, right? Because it doesn't have to be in uniform Hubble flow. So the centroid of that fault plasma is moving relative to the Hubble flow, then you get a little kinematic effect. And the peculiar velocity in this case is 400 kilometers a second, plus or minus 1,000. Right? That's a hard thing to measure. But it's there, right? So you can go out and do this. And that integrated change depends basically on the density of the electrons, their temperature, and the angular diameter distance. Because now you can go and say, how big is that thing on the sky? And the nifty thing about this effect is that you're measuring that angle, and so it's an angular diameter distance. And remember, that flattens out when you get to high redshift, because of the way it relates to the proper distance in 1 plus z. And so basically, this is fairly distance independent. You should be able to detect this effect as well at redshift 2 as you can at redshift 1. And that's, in principle, great. You can do all the cosmology tricks that we've been talking about way far out. The big downside at this is that we kind of do have to know what the physical size of the cluster is. And the one assumption you can't get away from is that your ball of plasma is a sphere. There's no such thing as a spherical Tau cluster. They're always a mess. And so you're measuring the angular size, but what you need to know is the line of sight distance through which it's propagation. If you assume it's a sphere, then they're the same, right? And that's how you can get a distance out of it. Like I said, it's almost never true for any individual cluster. So to do this, you need to average over a bunch of clusters. And then it gets hard. But people have done it, and I went to see if there was an update to this, and the answer is no, for the difficulties I think I just described. But you get a reasonable number, 69. Plus or minus 8 is not really helpful these days. It was when this was published, competitive. And there are other things you do have to worry about. There's the optical depth just due to this effect. You have to equate that size with the angular extent of the cluster on the sky. I'm just eyeballing what is the angular size of that blob? I mean, you can measure it, but it's not a nice, cleanly defined thing. And what you really want to know is the distance that the photons have to propagate through. And of course, it's not a sharp edge either, right? There's some density distribution of electrons through which you're propagating. And so that's your average optical depth for one thing. But to get this right, you really want to know the distribution of electrons, which you just have to guess. So it helps to measure the X-ray flux, and that gives you some extra constraint on what the temperature and density is to do all this. Okay, fine. So that's hard to do. You need both the X-ray data and the microwave background data. But it can be done. And so this is one of the many things that people have tried. Okay, and then I think finally for these direct geometric absolute methods, our water masers, this is kind of a cool effect. So first of all, you do get natural masers
growing in space. There are sometimes conditions in the interstellar medium where you get these large-scale amazing events. So that right away is kind of mind-boggling. We're used to thinking of masers or lasers as something that happens in controlled cavities where you can cause a population inversion. And it's not obvious that this should happen naturally, but sometimes it does. And so you can see those maser lines very easily enough that you can actually do very long baseline interferometry. That's where you coordinate signals from radio telescopes all around the world to get super high angular resolution. That's of course how the black hole in M87 was imaged, as was the one in the center of the Milky Way,
which is pretty much all we can hope to do. Those are objects that have angular scales that are about, that are well suited to the technology that we have, not many others. But anyway, in this particular example, NGC 4258 is a famous case. You will see that name checked later on because this is basically an absolute touchstone. It's a distance to a galaxy that's 7 megaparsecs away or something like that. You have this water maser. It's the H2O molecule. Has a line at 1.35 centimeters that mazes. And you can see it orbiting a supermassive black hole at the center of this galaxy. It's not that huge as those things go. A few times 10 to the 7 solar masses, if I remember right. But it has this mazing that allows you to both measure the Doppler velocity, but with VLBI you get enough angular resolution that you can see the blobs moving on the sky. You get proper motion. Right, so you get both a radial velocity and a transverse velocity, and that lets you work out the geometry of the orbit. And so here it is. These are offsets in milliarcseconds, a very high resolution. Just the offset on the sky, and then the velocities. You can see one side is going away from you, the other is coming at you, and those dotted lines are just the Keplerian curve for however many solar mass black holes. So you know that mass really well, but you can also use these velocities, transverse and radial, to work out what the distance is, because basically they're in very nearly circular orbits. And so you can work out the geometry. Again, this looks complicated, and that's partly just because they've normalized everything to the nominal values. So the nominal value to this thing is distance of 7.2 megaparsecs. So okay, what's that number? Is it 7.21? It's always gonna, all these things are gonna be near to one. What is the inclination of the thing? It's nearly edge on, or you wouldn't see the effect. It's around 80 degrees, you know, so forth and so on. But it is just the geometry of these things going around that you can measure both the transverse and the radial velocity in order to get that. Measuring that line of sight velocity and the proper motion, and then you can combine these to get the distance. And so that's been done very well for 4258. There was another project to do this for more galaxies, the Mega Maser Cosmology project. And so again, you get about a half a dozen things, like you did with lenses, where you can actually find the masers and measure them well enough to do this and get further out. And so that's the result of the project. A couple of the error bars are big enough to have little impact. But still, you get a fairly consistent Hubble flow out of that. And again, there's all the combined constraints and averages out to 74. Again, this is no reference to Cepheids, Tip of the Red Giant Branch, or any of the other traditional calibration things. It's just using the geometry of the orbits in the system where the masers are observed. Masers in our Milky Way 2, which are used to try to measure how far we are from the galactic center, but we're so close to them that it's actually, you have to worry about the distribution of which side they're on. It doesn't work out so well. Anyway, so those are
absolute distance measurements that are independent of any of the lower rungs on the distance scale ladder. So you can put all these things to do. This is a plot Adam Rees and his collaborators made and updated every once in a while. That basically shows the continuity from nearby to far away. So we're not talking about the absolute calibrators anymore, though you do see that name checked. There's NGC 4258. There's that major galaxy we were just talking about. But how well do we calibrate these things? And if we fail, then there should be a discontinuity along this line. So here is the distance modulus from Cepheids, the distance modulus from geometry, so basically trigonometric parallax, to get you the distances to Cepheids in the Milky Way. That's what's calibrating this. So there's the absolute method, there's its calibration. Do it in the OMC and Andromeda and the major galaxy 4258. And so that's our Cepheid calibration. Now we can go out a step on the distance ladder. This is the next run. Rung where we're now using the Cepheid distance modulus to calibrate something else, in this case, type 1A supernova. So there are now 42 supernova in this calibration with a very small scatter. So it looks pretty good. And then you can use that calibration to probe cosmology. And the scatter is still pretty small, though now you do have to measure the deceleration parameter. And then you can have a term in there for the jerk, which in principle needs to be there. But the impressive thing here is the linearity on this log-log plot over many magnitudes, right? So we have a distance modulus of 10, up to 30 here, 35, up to 40. So we have 30 magnitudes in the distance modulus. That is a big dynamic range, and it looks nice and continuous as if we actually knew what we were doing. And you can look at the scatter and say, that's off, but basically, the residuals look pretty good. Not perfect, but pretty good. And there has been a number of publications recently by this group, SHOES, led by Adam Rees, that's basically saying, we did this with HSD, let's do it with JWST. Oh, we get the same answer, basically what it boils down to. Which is a very short way of saying there are a lot of cross-checks that people have been doing. So far, it all seems consistent, and the answer is 73. And this uncertainty now, he's wrapped the systematic error into the uncertainty, so that's both. I don't like doing that because there's really no guarantee that those things add in quadrature. Random errors do, but systematics don't necessarily. In general, they do not in astronomy. And so this. So the random error is somewhere around 0.7, if I remember, which is 1% accuracy, right? 70 plus or minus 0.7. That's really, really good. And that's where we're at right now. So if we believe that error bar, then there's basically no way that the Hubble constant can be below 70. That's a 3 sigma discrepancy. OK, so what is it? Here is a compilation of fairly recent measurements of the Hubble constant. This was done by Di Valentino a few years ago, and so of course keep adding points to this, but I declined the opportunity to do that some more. But you can see why there's a tension. Here are all the so-called direct measurements, the traditional ways of measuring them locally. That are consistently giving an answer in the low 70s. So there's Cepheid-based calibrations of type 1A supernova. There's tip of the red giant branch calibrations of type 1A supernova. And those come out a little lower than those, and that's why I say there's a tension between DRGB and Cepheids, at least the way those people are doing it. But then there are a bunch of other things, right? Here's the Mazur result that I mentioned. Here's the Tully-Fisher results that I mentioned. Surface brightness fluctuations, type 2 supernova, lensing that we talked about. In principle, you can do this with gravitational waves. Again, there's a geometric effect there. Right now, the accuracy is not useful. But in principle, that's another thing that we'll get to use. Now, I've highlighted here, just for these two cases, because I know them well. This is another example where the authors make a choice. It is a choice, not wrong necessarily, but it's not a choice that everyone would make, to combine the random and systematic errors in quadrature. So in one sense, that's a good way to get a handle on the overall errors. On the other hand, it's not a good way to compare to scatter. See, these points don't look like they're independent. And they're probably not. They're probably some of the same people in some of these groups. So you have to look at this is recent all 2016, this is recent all 2019, and how much different are those results really. But the other thing is that the systematics may dominate the size of the error bars, so the scatter will not look as big as it should if it were just the random errors. So in this case, I've shown what the random error is separately from that total error. And then it gets interesting, right? Because this is barely consistent with this band. You could actually talk about the tension between Tully-Fisher and type 1a supernova. 75 versus 73. I don't believe that, right? That's all within the uncertainties. But in principle, that's a serious measurement. It kind of washes that over to just combine those two things. So I redid this plot to make it look different. So it's the same data. But I've done a few things here. So this is a value of Hubble constant plotted against date, and I wanted to keep the key project in here. So the HST Key Project reported in 2001. That was why Hubble was built. That was what Congress was sold on doing it, was they will go out, we'll launch this thing, we'll be able to see individual Cepheids in enough other galaxies that we can measure a Hubble constant like that. And you know what? It worked. That's what HSD did during the 90s, and we got 72 plus or minus 2. So that's the random error, but people were still worried about the systematic, so there's another plus or minus 6, so that light gray bar is the systematic uncertainty that they look at. That's the random uncertainty. And so there's been a lot of progress since then, but it's mostly been in reducing that systematic. That's what we've been doing so far this century. Now I've color-coded these points by which method we're using. So the blue points, the darker blue points, are calibrated by Cepheids. The orange points calibrated by the tip of the red giant branch. So again, you can see the tension between Cepheids and tip of the red giant branch. There are some things that use both where we don't see the tension, so whichever. And then there are these two geometric methods, the absolute methods we were talking about, both lensing and mega-masers. Now, you see a whole bunch of open circles there. Those are things that have random errors bigger than 3 kilometers per second per megaparsec. You plot all those error bars, it's just a forest of error bars, right? So this is an important thing. You want to emphasize the good data, not just stuff that gives you a giant error bar. So if you just plot everything the same way, then it looks like you don't know anything because there's just a giant forest of error bars. Again, quality control. Okay, shoes, this is that result I just told you about from Reese's group, that plus or minus 73, plus or minus 1, basically. Tully's result is formally more accurate, formally more precise, but less accurate. The systematics are still bigger. But you can see how these things vary and why there's a tension between these things and the CMB. Now we will discuss later why the CMB gives you this number, and it really does give you that number. It really has to be that with that tiny error bars, and that's why there's a tension. So not to denigrate that, just to say that that difference is real. And these things are consistent within their errors, and I even did the exercise of asking how much scatter there should be, and it's almost the right amount. Maybe not quite, so maybe there's still some confirmation bias going on. I always have to worry about knowing an answer. And confirmation bias is a really subtle thing. It's not just, I'm going to change this until I get the right answer I know I'm supposed to get. So that happens. But there are a whole lot of more subtle psychological effects. There's a whole literature on that in the psychology papers about how your results can be influenced by knowing what the answer should be in some sense. I wonder if that's happening here. This I've given the most recent number, but that went back to predate that. It's already known. And I know the people involved and where they're at and who they're talking to, and it's just like, yeah. That's what would happen if you were influenced by that. I don't know if that's what's going on. You can never be sure. But so this group has been consistently getting 69, which sounds like it's consistent with the CMB. But I would say that's not even really true. It's only true because the error bars here are big enough. The CMB wants to be to 67, goddammit, and nothing else. So that's certainly... There's no formal tension there given the size of the error bars, but it's not really right either. And pretty much the other thing I did in making this plot was I give each group only 1 point, right? So, you know, Reese has been doing this for a while, so he has lots of points. That's just the most recent one. That's our point. That's Tully's point. Tully's been doing this forever, so he also has another point. Just 1 point per group. So those are all at least independent groups doing that. There's even a measurement of the surface brightness fluctuation that is formally precise enough to get over this, under this 3 kilometer per second uncertainty. So, you know, that's where it's at now. And this point is clearly different from those points, and that is why we have a tension. Questions? All right, I know this is all kind of deadly dull and confusing to go through all this, what the hell is SE effect. But, like I say, I wanted you to at least be familiar with those methods, and later on we'll talk about why that really is where it is. So, my own opinion at the moment is that this is a real tension and something is messed up. I think, for a long time, the majority opinion is that, yeah, we've gotten this wrong before, we're getting it wrong now, but you know, there are a lot of cross-checks and a lot of independent things, so it's getting harder to sustain that narrative. And it's not like there can't be systematics there, too. We just haven't got the rich history of screwing that up the way we do with those things. Okay, I think that's a good place to stop, so we'll stop a little early. If you did not already, graded exams are up here, so feel free to come get that.